Hi, welcome to BCI Cattle Chat. I'm Brad White, joined today by Bob Larson, Bob Weber, and Sarah Bowser. Welcome.
Good morning, Brad.
Good morning.
We're happy to have everybody with us this morning, and Sarah comes with us. She's managing director for the Center for Sorghum Improvement, and we're going to talk a little about sorghum today. Before we get into that, there's a couple things I want to address, and I want to start off. Bob Larson has a unique talent that few know about, more will know now, but he can name the county seat of almost every county in Kansas. So he's...
Oh, you put the pressure on, yeah.
Yeah, I'm you're very
well.
Well,
this is a skill I got from my father. He would, you know, see a license tag and name the county and quiz us kids about, well, where is it? What's the county seat? And my dad knew them all. I'm not quite as good as he is.
So now I'm going to ask you, and I'm not going to go to Kansas counties. I'm going to ask you guys if you know which state has the most counties in the top 10 for beef cow numbers. So there is, if we look at the top 10 counties that have beef cows, which state do you think is number one? Now, this is different than which state has the most beef cows.
Right. I know my guess would be Nebraska because of those large counties up there in the northwest part of the state that have a lot of cows.
I'm going to go with Nebraska as well.
Likewise.
Yes. The top four beef cow counties are in Nebraska. Any other?
Cherry.
Cherry's got to be number
Sheridan.
One.
Sheridan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cherry, Holt, Custer, and Lincoln.
Lincoln.
And each of those are Cherry's 148,000 beef cows, goes down to Lincoln at 80,000 beef cows. Those are the top four.
Those are some, if you like cows, those are some areas that have cows.
Well, the other,
Brad, do you have the population numbers for those counties, human population?
I don't.
Not large. We were driving through that country just last week, and it's beautiful, and it looks great this year. Yeah, it's really beautiful cow country, and if you like cows, that is a great place.
Some friends from Montana that are moving to near Arthur, Nebraska, and the county has less than 600 people in it.
Yeah, that's awesome, isn't it?
I thought it was a great idea. I mean, the traffic jam in Arthur is
almost
like,
an ideal location.
So it's an interesting, as you look across the country, and then the density of both people and cows varies by parts of the country, and a lot of that's forage base as we look at how many cows per acre. A couple other things that as we go through today, one of the things we're going to do is talk about the Center for Sorghum Improvement and some of the things that they have done. And especially working with the cattle industry, but also just crop improvement, how we're moving forward. We're also going to discuss fall calving because we're at that time of year. And then we're going to talk a little bit about fly control. Several of you, and we appreciate you responding to our poll question, several of you responded to that. So we're going to talk about fly control as we get towards the end of the podcast. Before we get into that, there was some news this week that wasn't very good. Came out of Holcomb, Kansas, where the Tyson plant there had a fire and they've shut down that plant for a period of time. We don't know how long it'll be till they've got back up, but it does have an impact on really all of us because it changes the packing capacity, lowers it,
and that impacts all segments of the beef chain down to the cow calf and even
we've seen the markets react to that some, and the markets typically don't like uncertainty.
Right.
And there's a lot of uncertainty surrounding this. When's it going to come back? What's the next step?
And it made me think of some of our discussions a few weeks ago talking about risk management. And this would be one of those risks. There's not much I can do to manage it. But, again, even just being aware of the way life can throw you a curveball like this and having some resiliency, I don't know what that might be, but some changing the feeding plans to change the growth rate. So market endpoints, timing, just anything you can do, even though you may not have a lot of tools in the toolbox. This is another one of those. At least being aware of the risks that are out there and having some resiliency built in.
Yep. Because there's nothing we could do to prepare for that.
No.
So hopefully
that one that just kind of hits you from left field.
Yeah. We'll be hoping for the best that everybody that's been affected by that. So, and we'll provide updates as we get more information. But I want to jump to, and Sarah Bowser's with us today. We're glad to have you with us. You're the managing director for the Center for Sorghum Improvement, or CSI, a different CSI. I'm sure nobody's made that joke before about which CSI you work with.
They're all about original material.
That's exactly right. So tell us what you do and what CSI does.
Well, Brad and Bob, thanks for having me here. It's fun to have a conversation to talk about sorghum and connectivity back to the cattle industry. both economic drivers for the state of Kansas and unique ways to the land and the people of our state. The Center for Sorghum Improvement is housed in the College of Agriculture at Kansas State University, and within that program is the Collaborative Sorghum Investment Program. That's a program that was started just a couple years ago with founding investment from the National Sorghum Checkoff, the Kansas Grain Sorghum Commission, Kansas Department of Agriculture, and Kansas State coming around and acknowledging that sorghum is a critical crop, but it's also a small crop relative to some of the other crops, around 5 million acres across the United States, with nearly 50% of those acres in the state of Kansas, closely followed by production in other states that cross the plains, Texas second, and then depending on the year and the rainfall, Nebraska, Oklahoma, South Dakota quickly fall into that mix of production states. And so with the importance to the state of Kansas and the size and the type of the crop, the capacity at Kansas State within the Center for Sorghum Improvement is really a convening capacity. I spend a lot of time working with either technology providers and seed companies, having conversations about what's in the pipeline, what are connecting capacities to research tools and technologies that we can support private seed companies that deliver products to growers of sorghum, and then end users, what are their needs? How can we drive value for the crop? I certainly am a big believer in demand-driven outcomes for industries, and so how do we connect those needs of end users back into a seed product that drives value not only in stability of agronomic yield, but also in outcomes for end users? And so that's a lot of what brings me to the table here today, recognizing the significance and notability of the cattle production and cattle feeding in the state of Kansas and surrounding states.
Absolutely. And we talk about sorghum from a grazing standpoint, from a grain production standpoint. I know you've done some research looking at cattle feeding and sorghum. And is it all the same? So does it matter what variety of sorghum I pick and feed it to the cattle, or are there some differences?
Sorghum's a really unique crop, and its presentation of genetic diversity and the extremes of genetic diversity and the type of different crops that we can have. So in a general speaking term, we can break sorghum into a couple different types. We have forage types, we have biomass types, and then we have grain types. I spend a lot of my time in the grain type, but certainly recognize the value of other types.
Tell me a little difference between the forage type, biomass, and grain type. What differentiates them?
So it's all the same species and family, but it's more an outcome of selection pressure. So when breeders have went in and selected on a crop, for instance, the biomass days when we really had a lot of onerous and interest in looking at biomass and cellulosic fuel, there was identification of sorghum as a great productive species for biomass material. And so selecting for those really tall, fruitful, hardy plants that put on a lot of green mass and material.
And that would be for making fuel.
Fuel. So that's cellulosic. And then we have selection. You can also select for a grain head where that plant is allocating majority of resources and capturing solar radiation, capturing fertility and water within the system, and putting the majority of those resources to that grain fill and maximum grain unit. And then we have that balancer within that mix of forage types. And so really identifying that mix of putting on that leaf and that forage material, that biomass, as well as energy within that grain head. And so it's the same plant family, but it's more been human selection pressure that's identified those different categories. Going back to sorghum diversity, there's over 40,000 different accessions of sorghum, and a lot of that's been untapped. It's simply a process of allocating resources to selection to develop. A unique property of sorghum relative to a lot of the other grains that we see is sorghum, relative to other grains, has an open panicle, and so it puts the fruit of that plant, the seed for the next generation, right up looking at Mother Nature. Mm-hmm. We think about the other crops that we grow, particularly in Kansas. Soybeans have a pod covering those seeds. Wheat has awnings. Corn has husk. But sorghum says, give it to me, Mother Nature. I'm going to put my seed up here. And so what happens as a function of that is that seed pericarp encapsulates a lot of defense mechanisms for that seed. So we start to think about, and you know, when you go grocery shopping nowadays, you see antioxidants, phenolic compounds, all of these wonderful things that will fix whatever other dietary poor decisions you may or may not make. We see a drive towards looking and exploring and understanding what but phenolic compounds can provide for antioxidants. And a lot of those are packaged within grain sorghum. Grain sorghum is a cereal grain that offers a lot of potential nutrition traits, and it's because of that adaptation that we've seen with an exposed grain head over the millennia.
Yeah, and I think that is an interesting aspect. You talk about the variety, and we see people use sorghums in a variety of ways in cattle production. So it may be after harvest, grazing the stalks.
We
see that in the winter. Yeah. You see it in the summer because the sorghum or sorghum mixes, so sorghum Sudan, especially in the heat of summer, is nice because you may not have much else green out there, but that part is green.
Exactly. Some of those, as a cow-calf producer or stalker operator, having the ability to run some cattle on green-growing forages, such as a sorghum Sudan, is a great advantage to have. So we really like, and you know, you point out something that I should have recognized, but you know, and so I'm speaking just what I see with my eyes. I don't see a lot of differences. I know there's different corn varieties, and I know there's different soybean varieties and growing season lengths and things like that. But visually, they look very similar. Sorghum would be one, you know, using the extreme examples of forage sorghum versus grain sorghum, but even within grain sorghum, I can see a lot more genetic diversity. I suppose that doesn't necessarily mean there is more, but it does seem like there's a lot more varieties out there that we're using in livestock production.
Kind of sounds like the cattle. We've got some genetic diversity.
Yeah, some genetic diversity. So, well, and how, Sarah, as you see that genetic diversity playing out in sort of a sustainability context, what opportunities are there for us to change cropping systems a little bit to incorporate more either forage or grain sorghum in Kansas, because it's a water thrifty crop, and so I think, you know, my view is it's got a lot of opportunities for us in Kansas as we think about managing water resource. What challenges and opportunities lie there?
Absolutely. So both on the challenge and opportunity spectrum, when I think about my husband and I, we farm, and I know a community of farmers and decision makers across the state. When you think about the type of seasonal patterns that you're going to have at spring planting date, that's often unknown.
Right. And so I don't know how dry the summer is going to be with the time I'm making those decisions.
Absolutely. And especially if you're an integrated operation where you're diversified with a cow-calf or a backgrounding system built into that, you really have a need, an almost inelastic need, to have feedstuff production within that. So if I think about a season, let's take spring planting into that fall crop harvest time frame. If I can plant more than one crop type, suddenly I am shifting and experiencing different environmental conditions. So there's key pollination time for corn, key flowering time for sorghum. Those are critical time periods for yield determination. And can I experience different weeks for each of those? We know just last week we were talking about the weather, and this week going forward, we may experience rainfall that's key, or we may experience heat in certain time frames. And so diversifying our portfolio of exposure to various weather conditions is a critical component of that. I'd also say, going back to genetic diversity and what we have or haven't done, up until very recent time in the past several decades, our selection has been by visual eye. Mm-hmm. And so we could anecdotally understand what supports nutrition and health outcomes and animal performance or other end users, but our degree of sophistication was pretty crude. And so as we've started to develop more high throughput quality analysis, just running starch analysis for various crops, and then starting to further dissect those, we can gain a much more integrated understanding of what we produce on the field, how it supports end users, all the way from ethanol plants to cattle feeders to human consumers.
And I think some of the research you've done there at CSI has been really important, and I think that's something, and we'll put some links in our show notes so they can direct and find some of that research. But I think that's an area where we continue to learn more and more about where does it fit into these different systems. And it may also be an area, we were talking before you got on the show, about working with your agronomist or your local extension person and saying, okay, if I'm thinking about sorghum as a grain crop, or if I'm thinking of it as a cover crop, or I'm thinking of it as something to put out as my forage base, that may be an area I want to get more information on.
Yeah, and the concept of sorghum in Kansas, a couple of things you've said, you know, I knew that Kansas was a leading sorghum producer, but you said like half of the country's sorghum right here in Kansas, but also that draws back to maybe not as much research been done on this crop compared to corn, which is grown on more acres, more parts of the United States. And so maybe some opportunity as we look forward for faster improvement than in some of those crops where we've already invested a lot in research. So I'm glad that the CSI is here at K-State. I think that is it. You know, looking forward to the near future, some real opportunities for some benefit.
Yeah, and we've talked about sustainability and kind of the, you mentioned the systems and what happens when we think about it beyond an individual crop. So you mentioned corn or sorghum or cattle, and often we have a compartmentalized view of each of those industries, but they're very interrelated, and that's some of the research you've done.
Yeah, when I start to think about end markets that matter and also have geographic synergies with sorghum, cattle feeding comes to mind. Cattle feeding in accumulation of Texas and Kansas consumes 500 million bushels of energy-based feed grains every year. And so within that pie is corn, barley, wheat, and sorghum. And sorghum is less than 2% of that. And so how can we better leverage and advantage our regional production of sorghum into cattle feeding? And first, we have to acknowledge where are the barriers that prevent that from occurring today. Simply efficiency. If I'm a cattle feeder and I need to maximize output of my feed mill and my feed mill processing, any change to just this fine grain machine that can be optimized to one grain and one seed that looks exactly the same and is readily available creates a barrier to my efficiency. And so if I want to identify a sorghum that fits and advantages into cattle feeding, I need to be cognizant of the barrier and the need to overcome that decision maker and offer value to it. And so we've done screening of really that supports an innovation culture of screening of products that are already on the market that could support first adoption, sorghum hybrids that are already on the market, and then also sorghum, we have various panels that represent genetic diversity within sorghum, and so we took a subset of the sorghum diversity panel in the lab of Jim Drouillard here on K-State campus. He's done screening in a benchtop looking at susceptibility of different grains and different cultivars of sorghum to digestion for the rumen. And we've seen great variance. Mm-hmm. We've seen opportunities to have step change and potential value and efficiency that supports animal performance. And we're continuing that work to really go back and identify not just selecting cultivars that work well for agronomy, but also work well and advantage animal performance. And we're excited about the results for
sorghum. And I think that is where we talked about the value of diversity. But then we got to pick one, because if we're going to be efficient, we need to understand that one and how it works. And I think that is exciting work. We'll also put links to that in the show notes. I want to shift gears a little bit as we talk about sorghum coming through the summer, and I want to talk about fall calving, and at least just briefly, as you guys think about it, here we sit mid-August, it's time.
Yeah. It is time.
Yeah, we're starting to see. I'm starting to see some calves on the ground, And, you know, in Kansas and in this area, certainly most of the calves are born in the spring, but a fair percentage are born in the fall. And there's a lot of reasons why that might work for a particular operation. But some of the things we talked about last spring are going to be important for fall calving as well. Is, you know, be prepared to help your heifers particularly. They're more likely to have calving difficulty. Have your veterinarian on notice that calving has started. And the other interesting thing, and we saw an article that came across our desk recently, is kind of a reminder that the environmental temperature does affect how long pregnancy lasts. And high temperatures late in pregnancy will tend to shorten the length of gestation. Therefore, if we use a typical 283-day or 285-day pregnancy length for a herd that calves in the spring, it may be several days shorter than that in the fall, a week or so shorter than that. And so, again, you were talking about calving season is starting, and if I expected it to start 1st of September, it may actually be starting right now.
Yep. Yeah, that roll-up can kind of catch you off guard, particularly if you view the combination of already some short gestation calving yeast genetics.
Yeah, so I've got some heifers bred.
Temperature will, I mean, it wouldn't be uncommon to have calves a couple weeks earlier than you might sort of typically expect. So
now
be prepared.
There are some other differences between spring and fall, because a lot of times in spring, and I'll ask you guys to elaborate, but a lot of times in spring, I'm in a confined environment. Let's define spring, because we call it spring, and
really
we mean
winter.
February.
Yeah, it's winter. It's winter calving.
Right? But that's what we call spring calving.
Right.
So I'm in a confined environment. I'm providing all their nutrition, and I'm basically making sure the water's not frozen. What about now?
Yeah, well, the weather concerns are very different. Instead of snow and rain, cold temperatures and moisture, we're really worried about heat stress and heat exposure. And these young calves are not able to handle, they don't have as wide a safety area for temperature as an adult animal. And so we can get to some heat stress, and so that needs to be considered.
Yep, certainly in the, if we think about yesterday, for example, it was only 92 or 93, but the humidity was really high. The heat index was 114 or 115, making sure we've got our grazing plan so that those cows are in a spot where they've got some shade or cover. That complicates calving, though, right? Because potentially those cows may be quite a ways from facilities. Checking cows that are in a bunch of trees is lots of fun. We've got to be prepared for that. And the upside is typically less dystocia calving problems in fall cows than spring cows. But, if we've got heifers and that sort of thing, we still have a need to monitor those on a pretty frequent basis.
So. Yeah, the other thing I'd throw in there is ample access to water. And not all water is the same. So making sure they have access to good, clean water, can get to it and don't have to truck too far back and forth. Yeah. So I think that leads us to our Cattle Chat checklist for this week, which is our top 7 tips for fall calving.
All right, number 7 is fly control. These young calves, newly born calves, are very sensitive to being attacked by flies. Now, we're not going to put fly control directly on the calves. We're going to make sure that the cows are well controlled.
Number 6, forage management. We want to be sure that as they calve, they're going to have higher nutritional requirements. I've got a plan for getting them onto those pastures and make sure I'm moving them appropriately.
Sure. Number 5 is earlier calving. So we know that cows that undergo some heat strain will calve a little bit earlier. So be prepared. If your September 1 calving date is what the book says, a week or two before that, I'd make sure I've got all my stuff ready to go because you could sure have a few calves show up.
All right. Number 4 is heat stress. In comparison to our spring calving cows, where we're concerned about cold temperatures, rain, those types of things. Heat stress is a big concern for these young calves. They're not able to handle high temperature, high humidity days as well as an older animal.
Number 3, water quality and quantity. Be sure that I've got it out there, they've got good access to it, and I keep a close eye on that because that's one of the ways that we're going to combat that heat stress.
Sure. Number 2, dystocia. So again, if you're calving, particularly some heifers, we know dystocia rates in fall calving cows typically are less than their spring calving counterparts, but certainly be prepared in case you've got heifers that are calving. Still some observation of those females likely warranted.
All right. And number 1, just be prepared for calving season. Have your equipment ready to go. Have the veterinarian's phone number at hand and be prepared for the start of calving.
Excellent. That's our top 7 list for things to get ready for fall calving. And we appreciate everybody that responded to our poll. And we ask about fly control. And we ask, what is your favorite or most frequently used fly control? We had options of you could use a pour-on spray, fly tag, put something in the feed. And what do you guys think came in first?
Well, I'm a little bit at an advantage here because I'm looking at the results right now.
So but, if you get it wrong, then I guess
it was interesting. I was a little bit surprised in that almost basically 2/3 of the respondents said that they used a spray or pour on, which I understand that because that allows you to really time fly control when you need it most. And I think that's a logical reason. We also had about 19% used fly tags. They're very convenient, they're more expensive, and they don't allow me to kind of alter during the season, but they're very convenient. And then finally, we had about 14% that used some kind of fly control in the feed, such as an IGR, incident growth regulator. And so I guess in some ways I'm not really surprised that was the breakdown. I thought maybe the percentage using fly tags would be a little bit more. So that's what I don't know what.
I thought fly tags would be a little more frequent, and maybe that's, I think maybe stocker guys tend to use those maybe a little more than cow-calf producers might, but certainly a little more cost in the fly tag, and your point on timing is critical that, you know, if you put them in too early, then you don't get good late season control. If, you know, some guys get really concerned about, you know, if I've got flies on the cows, I need fly tags. Well, there's a, about 200 flies per side is the sort of the break-even spot.
But the great thing about sprays and pour-ons is, I can make that decision today. That, you know, it seems like in the last week, fly numbers are really going up. Therefore, I can treat my cows or not. And the flexibility is nice.
So I can make the decision today, and the flexibility is nice. But I'll give the case example of I went out and looked at cows yesterday and said, yeah, they probably need some fly control. So I could have made the decision to do fly control, but they're not in a space where I can get them up easily. Yeah. I really, it's 114. I'm not running them through the
And so they didn't the get fly control.
So they didn't get fly control. So my idea of I can use a spray or a pour-on is great if they would all just stand there and let me walk up to them and do it. But for right now, I'm not doing it.
You need them bucket broke, man.
I do need them.
That's why I treated mine last week. Took a bucket of feed out. Bait them in a little bit and walk by, and there's a couple you had to be pretty quick. But
I guess that's where I'm screwing up. But I think the idea, pour on spray, as long as I can manage that timing and actually get it implemented. Mm-hmm. I like the idea a lot. Getting it implemented is hard.
As always.
I'd say the same thing on fly tags, because I like the idea of fly tags, but sometimes we implement those in March or April and they're too far ahead of the fly season. They don't cover me to this time of year. So flies are difficult, and one of the things that makes them most difficult is you can see the dang things, mm-hmm. right? I mean, they're out there, they're on the cows, you look at them, you go, they got a bunch of flies, I need to do something.
There's very few other things that I can actually see.
Yes, so I went out, looked at them, said, yeah, they got a fair number of flies, I probably need to do something, and I'll say that again tomorrow. And,
maybe
this weekend. Yeah.
A little surprised that the feed-throughs weren't a little more popular. Yeah. Those can, particularly coupled with a either pour-on or a fly tag, can be a very effective sort of first line of defense. The challenge, obviously, you got to feed it year-round, but 30 days before, 30 days after frost, and make sure you get consumption. But for cattle that, you know, particularly if you've got some animals that you're in a mineral product that you get good mineral consumption, it can be really effective. So,
well, and I think the point of this and the poll is any of those methods can be effective. It is how you put it in play on your operation.
Yeah.
What works best for you, and give that thought beforehand, not, geez, I got flies out there. Not my situation. Geez, I got flies out there. What should I do now? So give it thought beforehand. So we have appreciated you joining us this week. If you have comments, questions, thoughts, please send us an email at bci@ksu.edu.